Here on FM, our book of the week is a new account of the life of the American writer Sylvia Plath and the years before her life-changing encounter with the poet Ted Hughes. Andrew Wilson's biography traces the early literary and emotional development of the author of The Bell Jar, first published 50 years ago. Hayley Atwell reads Mad Girl's Love Song by Andrew Wilson. Sylvia Plath's words are read by Sasha Pick.
On the 25th of February 1956, 23-year-old Sylvia Plath stepped into a room full of people and immediately spotted what she later described in her diary as a big, dark, hunky boy. Sylvia, in Cambridge studying on a Fulbright fellowship, had been drinking all night. Arriving at a party to celebrate the first issue of a new literary journal, St. Boltoff's Review, Sylvia felt like she could move through air like swimming with brave ease. The room was packed with young men in turtleneck sweaters and women in elegant black dresses. Counterpointing the jazz, the sound of poetry was in the air, great chunks of it being quoted back and forth. Sylvia tried to dance the twist with one of the contributors of the review, Lucas Myers. As she danced, she proceeded to recite the whole of Myers' poem, Fools Encountered, a piece she had read for the first time earlier that day in the review. When the music came to a temporary halt, she saw somebody approaching. It was the same hunky boy. He introduced himself as Ted Hughes. On first meeting, the attraction between Hughes and Plath was instant. But Sylvia sensed something else too.
There is a panther stalks me down. One day I'll have my death of him, she wrote in Pursuit, a poem that she composed 2 days later.
Plath recorded their encounter in her journal the next day. After she had quoted some lines of his poem, The Casualty, Hughes had shouted back over the music at her. You like? Did she want brandy? He had asked. Yes! She yelled back, at which point he led her into another room. Hughes slammed the door and started pouring her glassfuls of brandy, which Plath tried to drink. He told her he had obligations in the next room, another Cambridge student named Shirley. Then, suddenly, Hughes leant towards her and kissed her, bang smash on the mouth. He moved down to kiss her neck, and Plath bit him long and hard on the cheek. When the couple emerged from the room, blood was pouring down Hughes's face. Hughes left his mark on Plath and her reputation too. After her suicide in February 1963, as her estranged but not divorced husband, he became Plath's literary executor, the guardian of her writings, and, in effect, responsible for how she was perceived. The sensational aspects of the Plath-Hughes relationship, from that intense first meeting, through to their marriage only 4 months later, to the birth of their children, followed by Ted's infidelity and their separation, and then Sylvia's death at the age of 30, have dominated the cultural landscape to such an extent that their story has taken on the resonance of a modern myth. Hughes, in his role of editor of her collected poems, chose to confine a selection of 50 poems written before 1956 to a small section at the end. He said he would accompany the Juvenilia with a complete list of all the pre-1956 poems that survive. There is only one problem. The list is far from complete. One of the missing poems is the 1953 Villanelle, Mad Girl's Love Song, which Plath described as one of her favourites. The poem is written from the perspective of a young woman who is waiting for her date to turn up. And when she closes her eyes, the world drops dead, and she is forced to question whether her lover is real or just a projected fantasy. Has she really just made him up inside her head? She asks herself.
I wrote Mad Girl's Love Song once in a mad mood like this, when Mike didn't come and didn't come.
The Mike Sylvia refers to is Myron Lotz, one of a myriad of Plath's early boyfriends. Sex, or rather the constraints and repressions surrounding it, played a central role in Plath's creative and psychological development, as she wrote in her journal in the autumn of 1950.
I have too much conscience injected in me to break customs without disastrous effects. I can only lean enviously against the boundary and hate the boys who can dispel sexual hunger freely, without misgiving, and be whole while I drag out from date to date in soggy desire, always unfulfilled.
Not only did Plath feel maddened that she could not express herself sexually, but she was also furious that she had not been born into a family of greater means. As a scholarship girl at Smith College, she was surrounded by the daughters of the country's great and the good. She peeled potatoes, chopped vegetables, and waited on tables as a way of reducing her course fees. There is no doubt that writing was the outlet through which she could vent the host of negative feelings that crowded within her. In 1948, 16-year-old Sylvia wrote a poem, still unpublished, called Neither Moonlight Nor Starlight. In it, she tries to address the reasons why she feels compelled to write. Finally, she states,
"There is a voice within me that will not be still."
Plath's unsettled and unsettling voice, 50 years after her death, still has the power to haunt and disturb. Sylvia Plath was born in Boston, Massachusetts, on the 27th of October, 1932, the first child of Otto Emil Plath and Aurelia Frances Schober. He was 46, a professor of biology at Boston University, and she was a 25-year-old former student of his. Otto Plath, whom Sylvia would later immortalise in her poem Daddy, was born in Grabo, Germany. In 1900, Otto's grandfather, having heard of his grandson's brilliant academic record, paid for his passage from Hamburg to New York. Otto's work ethic was unremitting. After studying at Northwestern and Berkeley, he attended the Massachusetts Institute of Technology as an instructor in modern languages. Between 1921 and 1925, he studied zoology at Harvard. Otto had an interest in bees, which had grown into a scientific obsession. As soon as the couple married, their lives were taken over by Otto's work. Aurelia had always wanted to be a writer, but
I didn't feel that I could expose my children to the uncertainty of a writer's success or failure.
She had been born into a hard-working immigrant family. Her father, Franz Schober, was an Austrian who had arrived in America in 1903. Growing up in the Italian-Irish neighbourhood of Winthrop, Boston, Aurelia often suffered prejudice, especially during the years of the First World War. She found her escape in reading. When Aurelia met Otto, she admired him for his brilliant mind rather than the warmth of his personality. They mapped out their future together, a family of at least two children, and a book that they could work on together, which they provisionally entitled The Evolution of Parental Care in the Animal Kingdom. Aurelia took a job teaching English and German at Brookline High School, but after their marriage, she yielded to her husband's wish that she retire from work. By all accounts, Otto was something of a tyrant in the home. At the end of their first year of marriage, Aurelia realised that if she wanted her children to grow up in a peaceful home, she would have to become more submissive, although this was against her nature. She needed a project, something that could contain and channel her energies. The birth of her daughter Sylvia in October 1932 presented her with the perfect opportunity. In 1935, Aurelia gave birth to a second child, a boy, whom they called Warren.
I read and sang to them for hours and hours, and I encouraged them from their very first steps to be aware of all things about them. Shades of colour, shadows, colours within shadows. To have a painter's eye as well as a writer's eye.
Aurelia remembered one occasion, when Sylvia was about eight, when she took the two children down to the beach to watch the spectacle of the new moon.
I carried my son and she stood by my side, and she more or less drew away, stood apart and gazed at the moon. And then quietly I heard her start to say very slowly, "The moon is a lock of witch's hair, tawny and golden and red. and the night winds pause and stare at the strand from a witch's head.
One morning, in August 1940, Otto stubbed his little toe against the base of his bureau. Later that day, he returned home, limping, and when Aurelia convinced him to consult a doctor, he was diagnosed with diabetes mellitus. Several weeks later, Aurelia arrived home to find Otto lying prostrate on the staircase. He had left his bed to go downstairs into the garden to look at his flowers. The next day, the doctor arrived with a specialist, who informed Aurelia that in order to save Otto's life, he would have to amputate the leg. On the 5th of November, while asleep in the hospital, he suffered an embolism and died. He was 55 years old. Aurelia decided to wait until the morning to tell the children of their father's death. After hearing the news, Sylvia, who had just turned 8, turned to her mother and said, "I'll never speak to God again." After her husband's death, Aurelia was forced to take on the role as sole breadwinner. Sylvia would later feel resentful of what she saw as her mother's attitude of noble martyrdom, writing in her journal,
"Life was hell. She had to work. Work and be a mother, too. A man and a woman in one sweet, ulcerous ball. She pinched, scraped, wore the same old coat, but the children had new school clothes and shoes that fit."
In the summer of 1942, Aurelia was offered the chance to change her life. The dean of Boston University's College of Practical Arts and Letters had asked her whether she would be willing to develop a course for medical secretaries. Aurelia sold the family home in Winthrop and, with the help of her parents, bought a small, six-room, white-frame house in Wellesley. Aurelia had her sights set on her daughter's future. She knew that Wellesley's woman-only liberal arts college offered a limited number of scholarships to outstanding students. Achievement was central to Sylvia's world, as essential to her as the great love of her life, books. A great deal of her reading was done either in bed or sitting in the apple tree in the garden of Elmwood Road. It was in this very special place, she said in an essay she wrote 2 years later, that she found it easy for her imagination to take flight. The dull earth looked far away, the heavens a little nearer.
"Writing is not only my favorite hobby, but a means by which I can escape into another world, a world of lovely fantasy."
And tomorrow, a magazine publication of one of her short stories leads to a major new friendship for the teenage Sylvia Plath. Hayley Atwell was reading from Mad Girl's Love Song by Andrew Wilson. Sylvia Plath was played by Sasha Pick and Aurelia Plath by Hannah Wood. The book was abridged by Miranda Davis and produced by Emma Harding. And you can hear the first episode of Sylvia Plath's novel, The Bell Jar, as our book at bedtime, tonight at 10:45 here on BBC Radio 4. Well, eager Lewis Elliot starts his rise to power in Strangers and Brothers, C.P. Snow's English establishment epic about to start over on Radio 4 Extra. Here, after the news, the Mali musician Fatoumata Diawara performs live on Woman's Hour. Now, everyone has those certain issues that drive them up the wall, and the comedian Susan Kalman is no different. In a new series, she explores topics as wide-ranging as the death penalty and Scottish nationalism, and why they provoke such strong feelings in her. In the first episode, she tackles civil partnerships.
I mean, it made it easier that I grew up during the Thatcher years. Section 28 and Clause 28 made it particularly clear that my type of person wasn't, you know, very welcome. In fact, for many years, one of the benefits of being in a same-sex partnership was that you could say, "I really wish I could marry you, darling. It's just that the damn law won't let it."
Susan Kalman is convicted tomorrow night at 11 o'clock on the home of radio comedy, BBC Radio 4.